Today's guest, Jean Wiener, has spent 23 years working to protect Haiti's fragile coastal and marine ecosystem. He's in town to accept the Goldman Environmental Prize. As founder of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity in Haiti, Jean and his team provided data to support the creation of Haiti's first two marine protected areas. Haiti's environment has been severely threatened by pollution and deforestation. The reefs are the most overfished in the world. So what is being done to protect Haiti's natural resources? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Charles Carroll. The European Union will discuss the worsening crisis in the Mediterranean at an extraordinary summit on Thursday. The Council President, Donald Tusk, said that the EU couldn't accept hundreds of people dying as they tried to cross the sea. The EU Foreign Policy Chief, Federica Mogherini, said that a number of measures had already been agreed.
We've identified some actions. Some of them can be implemented in a reasonably short period of time. In particular, strengthening our presence in Niger, and that can solve one of the ways of access to Libya through its southern border. We've talked about other measures, intelligence cooperation, regional protection programs, but also the issue of destroying ships.
EU foreign ministers also stressed the need to improve the ability to save lives at sea. But the UN human rights chief said the EU is turning its back on the most vulnerable migrants in the world. A correspondent for the Washington Post newspaper in Iran has been charged with espionage. Jason Rezaian, who's an American-Iranian citizen, has been detained in Tehran for 9 months. The paper's editor described the charges as absurd. Here's Sebastian Usher.
The plight of Jason Rezaian has been regularly brought up by the US during talks aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear program. The new focus on his case, with charges against him for the first time being clarified, comes at a sensitive time, with the clock ticking down to a final deadline for the deal. His detention has long been seen as part of a strategy by hardliners in Iran to make life difficult for the comparatively moderate president, Hassan Rouhani, whose credibility depends on getting the nuclear deal agreed, thereby relieving the economic pressure of sanctions.
The king of the Zulu tribe in South Africa has called for an end to violence against immigrants from other parts of Africa. King Goodwill Zwelithini, whose earlier comments have been blamed for sparking the trouble, said the attacks were wrong and vile. At least 7 people have been killed in the violence, but many at the stadium listening to the king continued to voice hostility to foreigners, as Karen Allen in Durban reports.
Today, as the king urged restraint, the anti-foreigner sentiment seemed to remain, as the crowd booed the ambassadors representing the countries whose nationals have been affected, Zimbabwe and Mozambique among them. Some South Africans blame the immigrants for taking their jobs. And although many here stop short of condoning anti-foreigner violence, several told the BBC they wanted the migrants to go home.
The security forces in Guinea have clashed with opposition supporters in the capital Conakry during protests against the timing of elections. Police fired tear gas as demonstrators barricaded roads, burned tyres and damaged property. The opposition says the ruling party has used the outbreak of the deadly Ebola disease as an excuse to postpone elections. World News from the BBC. Russian anti-terrorist officials say special forces have killed the leader of the North Caucasus jihadist group known as the Caucasus Emirate. They say that Alyaskar Kebekov died alongside 4 other suspected militants in a shootout after special forces surrounded a house in Dagestan on Sunday. His wife was also said to have been killed. Organisers of a fund set up for the victims of the Rana Plaza clothing factory collapse in Bangladesh say they face a $6 million shortfall 2 years after the tragedy. On the eve of the second anniversary of Bangladesh's worst ever industrial disaster, they say that $24 million had been either paid or pledged to families of those killed and injured. More than 1,100 people were killed when the complex collapsed, and another 1,500 were badly injured. Scientists in Britain say they've discovered that the way the body clock adjusts between day and night depends not only on the intensity of light, but also on the changing colours of the sky. It's the first time the impact of colour has been tested. Here's Rebecca Morell.
At dawn and dusk, the colour of the light we see becomes more blue, and scientists at the University of Manchester in the north of England found that mice are sensitive to these changes. The researchers created an artificial sky and found that leaving the colour the same but adjusting its brightness set the rodent's body clock adrift. However, when they kept the light intensity level but adjusted its hue, the mice stayed aligned to day and night. The researchers believe their findings also apply to the human body clock.
An Armenian belly dancer in Egypt has been sentenced to 6 months in prison on charges of insulting the Egyptian flag. The dancer was convicted of wearing a flag-like costume at a Red Sea resort last year. Her lawyer said she intended no offence. Since last year, showing disrespect to the flag has been punishable by up to a year in prison. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Every year, the Goldman Environmental Prize honors grassroots environmental heroes and sheroes across the world. The prize recognizes individuals for protecting and enhancing the natural world, often at great personal risk. At tonight's event in San Francisco, Jean Wiener will be recognized for empowering poor Haitians to protect and restore their deteriorating marine environment by providing them with tools to create new opportunities. Through these efforts, Jean Wiener succeeded in establishing Haiti's first ever marine protected areas. For the past 20 years, Jean has been working with local communities in Haiti to protect and restore the marine environment. Jean is director and CEO of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity. That's an NGO that works to protect Haiti's coastal and marine resources. And Jean Wiener joins me in studio. Hi, Jean. Thank you for coming in.
Hi. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So before we dive in and talk about the amazing work that you do, why don't we talk a little bit about the current state of Haiti? Because unless you're really looking for information about Haiti, it's really not in the news on a regular basis here in the United States. Haiti is the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, with 80% of Haitians living in poverty. And then we can talk about the environment, just 1% of Haiti's original forest cover remains. So we got so much information after the earthquake. What is the state of Haiti today? I know it's a big question, but what are you really thinking about right now?
Well, right now, I can honestly say that it's gotten a lot better over the past 3 or 4 years. I think with the arrival of the new government and their interest in actually really making things move forward for Haiti in general, I think you've seen quite a significant change. We were on a constant downward spiral, I believe, since about the mid-1980s, between innumerable coups d'etats and political infighting and occupation by either the U.S. or the U.N. or whoever. I think that really there's been a stability over the past 3 or 4 years, which has changed the basic dynamics within the country. We've seen the development of newer hotels, of hospitals, the basic infrastructure, at least in terms of roads, has gotten better. We've had our ups and downs in terms of security. There's been kidnappings and various types of violence, but that has also diminished quite a bit. So in all, I think, honestly, after close to 30 years of really having a lot of uncertainty in terms of where the country was heading, that over the past 3 or 4 years, the country has really at least made a turn towards the better.
What explains that turn?
Well, I think it's in part the current government. I think it's also in part a maturity in terms of the political groups that are active in Haiti. It does take a while for a country to convert, if you will, from a dictatorship into a democracy. And we often like to joke also that it's not an effect of landing a container full of democracy at the port and saying, you know, here's your democracy, and you unload it and everybody has democracy. There's really a very large issue of education, and people really need to spend some time, and often it's years, understanding what democracy actually is and means. Mm. And I think that is part of the change which is coming about.
We got a lot of information in the media about the nearly 500,000 people that were still living in tents, 7,000 dead from diseases, hundreds of thousands infected. What is the status of the people who were most affected by the earthquake?
Well, a lot of people, as you probably know, left the Port-au-Prince area and headed out into the more rural areas in other parts of the country, left the most affected parts of Port-au-Prince. A lot of them are still homeless, although they may be living with other family members in other parts of the country. There are still small tent communities in Haiti. It's still sad to see that after all of this time, after all of the aid that has poured into the country, that this situation still exists. There have been various types of communities of housing developments made for some of the poorer sectors of the population. They also have had issues of their own in terms of who gets to move in, and even some structural issues which have been raised by various groups about the integrity of some of the structures. But all in all, I think considering the incredible disaster which occurred after the earthquake, I think a lot has been done. I'm certainly of the opinion that a lot more could have been done, and a lot certainly still remains to be done.
And I mentioned these numbers. This was 2 years after, but just to remind people how devastating this earthquake was, it killed 230,000, 300,000 injured, and 1 million left homeless. We saw a lot of support after the earthquake. $10 billion was raised, a lot of controversy around that. And then a lot of NGOs went to Haiti to do work, and that was also very, very controversial. What is the status of the thousands of NGOs that are working in Haiti? And are most of them still there today?
Well, certainly after the earthquake, a lot of NGOs, a lot of people wanted to help. That was great. I think a lot of people had certainly good intentions. A lot of NGOs at all levels in all sectors wanted to get into Haiti to help. And I think a lot of them really did want to. But there were also plenty of fly-by-night organizations which came in, people just trying to make a quick buck. A lot of what we'd call the vulture capitalists came in. And a lot of people who just managed to raise a lot of money and wanted to go down, maybe do a couple of quick things and then pocket the rest of the money. And I actually have a friend who at one point was responsible for an institution in figuring out how many NGOs there were actually working in Haiti at one point right after the earthquake, and he stopped counting at about 5,800.
5,800.
5,800. That's when he stopped, and he said he probably hadn't even reached the halfway mark. So a lot of NGOs, a lot of the bigger institutions certainly are still there. A lot of the smaller ones
on the bigger ones, there was some criticism that they had a patronizing attitude toward Haitians, that they weren't really working with local communities. They were coming in with a top-down approach, right? Like, we know what's best for you.
Right.
Has that changed with these big NGOs?
Unfortunately, for most of them, we're seeing that attitude continues. A lot of them enter into certain communities, and the attitude is pretty much, we have the money, we know what we're doing, and this is what you're getting, without actually engaging the local communities and asking them, really, is this what you even need? Hmm. I relate it sometimes to going into a community and telling them, okay, we're putting in an airport, and not even asking anybody if they need an airport. So it was and remains a pretty bad situation. I was just talking to another friend along and explaining to him, for us at least, because we've been working in Haiti We're a Haitian organization. We've been working in Haiti for 23 years, so we're in it for the long term. And after the earthquake, a lot of these institutions probably made things worse for organizations such as ours. A lot of these groups, as I said, came in and just ticked off boxes saying, okay, we did, you know, we made a house or we made two houses and tick off a box and be on their way. And what happened is that right now Haiti has virtually become almost a welfare state where a lot of people aren't expecting to have to work or to be engaged in activities to help themselves. They're expecting people, they call them the blancs, the whites. Mm-hmm. The blanc can be a foreigner as well, but the blancs to come in and just give them things. So for our organization, at least, we do not work that way in any way, shape, or form. As they say in French, je ne peux pas être plus royaliste que le roi. To translate loosely, I can't be more interested in helping you than you are interested in helping yourself. So we do not go into these various communities and just give out funding or give out help. People have to be willing to provide a counterpart. If we're doing a construction or something, they have to be able to provide some labor. They have to be able to provide some type of counterpart, no matter what it is, because they have to feel that they have a vested interest in whatever is being done so that they can have some pride in getting out of the situation in which they find themselves.
So are smaller NGOs using the wisdom of the local community to make situations better in different communities? I mean, is there that kind of work happening also?
Oh, absolutely. I think the larger NGOs, of course, have the power to fundraise and have the political power to get a lot of things done. But the actual work, as always, has always come from the grassroots mm-hmm. level, especially in countries such as Haiti, where you really need to get the local communities involved. And if they're not involved, there is no doubt that your project is not going to succeed. Mm-hmm. They have to be intimately involved, preferably from even the conception of the projects, to be able to have a sense of pride and ensure that their input, their interest in the project is secured and that the project becomes a successful one.
I'm speaking with Jean Wiener. He is director and CEO of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity. This is an NGO that works to protect Haiti's coastal and marine resources. And Jean is in San Francisco. He will be recognized tonight for empowering poor Haitians to protect and restore their marine environment. John just won the Goldman Environmental Prize, which honors grassroots environmental heroes and sheroes across the world. So, John, you've been working for the past 23 years on these issues. What would you say really works best when it comes to really empowering locals?
Well, in terms of empowering the local communities, it's really a question of providing them with, first of all, well, there are two components, but the first is providing them with education. In our case, we provide educational activities and association building activities in order to get the communities to really come together and function as a group, because we can't continue to work with individuals all the time. We need to have the local communities realize that they're better off if they work as a group on certain activities. So for the education activities, we work with youth all the way through adults on activities related to the environment in particular, the marine environment and coastal environment, because that's where we have our primary focus. And it's really a question of making sure that they know that there are options. And the second part of what we also do is begin to provide the alternatives. A lot of people, some of the major issues we're confronted with are overfishing, mangrove cutting, deforestation for charcoal production and fuel wood. So these issues we need to get a handle on these issues, and we also need to be able to provide the alternatives. I can no sooner ask you to quit your job and go find something else to do than I can the local fishermen, unless I provide you with an alternative to make your livelihood.
Right.
So a lot of people, and again, it's somewhat funny, but I have friends who just told me recently also that, you know, they have relatives who go down to Haiti from the States, and they go down and they just yell at everyone, stop cutting wood, stop fishing, stop, you know, destroying the environment. But without providing an alternative, you're just, you know, you're talking for no reason. So we're trying to engage our communities, at least, in that level of environmental protection management as well.
78% of Haitians earn less than $2 a day. About half live on a dollar a day or less. How do you approach these issues in a society where poverty is so rampant?
Well, there's no doubt that this is a tough one. It's taken us over 500 years to get into the situation that we are in now. And we're certainly not going to get out of it in a year or two of an injection of funding. So there needs to be a paradigm change at a certain level in terms of how people relate to their environment and how they relate to their livelihoods. Again, we need to provide the alternatives, and there needs to be an injection, no doubt, of knowledge. But along with that injection of knowledge, there needs to be the injection of financing and funding to be able to provide the startup capital and startup activities. But in the end, the local people still need to take full responsibility for the fact that the environment is degraded, for the fact that mangroves are being cut and made into charcoal, for the fact that fisheries are pretty much completely depleted. And there's a mentality, unfortunately, which we encounter everywhere we go, in which there's a lot of finger-pointing, as there is in a lot of other places, but in Haiti in particular, where everybody points the finger at somebody else. Everything from it's the government's fault that the fisheries are depleted, to it's not us cutting the mangroves, it's the guys over in the next village who are cutting the mangroves. Then the guys in the next village say, no, it's not us, it's the guys in the previous village who are cutting the mangroves. So all of that, we really need to get a handle on making sure that people feel responsible for the situation that they're in. I tell my fishermen all the time when they come and complain to me and they say, well, you know, the fisheries are depleted and it's the government's fault and the government should do more. And I have to tell them, I don't remember the last time I saw the government out here fishing. It's not the government who came out here and took all the fish. So it's the question of giving everyone the responsibility for their own actions and for the situation that they find themselves in. Enough of the finger pointing. It's time to point the finger back at yourself and make sure that you're taking responsibility for what's going on around you.
What kind of reaction do you get when you respond like that?
Well, they often look at me a little bit confused, but then they really begin to realize, you know, that maybe I'm right in saying, you know, I haven't seen the president. You're saying that it's the president's fault. I haven't seen the president out here fishing. I understand that there's a need for rules and regulations and for the enforcement of rules and regulations, but it's still the local people who are out there exploiting the resources who are the responsible parties.
I'm speaking with Jean Wiener. He is president and director and CEO of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity, an NGO that works to protect Haiti's coastal and marine resources. And Jean will be recognized tonight at the Goldman Environmental Prize Award Ceremony. It honors grassroots environmentalists across the world, recognizing them for protecting and enhancing the natural world. And Jean, you've been doing this work for 23 years. You established your NGO in 94 to address severe environmental issues affecting Haiti. What got you interested in this work?
Well, I've always been interested in the ocean. Ever since I can remember, going to the beach with my parents. Of course, I was one of those kids which, my parents would have to yell at me to get out of the water when it was time to go home. My fingers and toes would be all shriveled from being in the water for so long. But I remember going out and snorkeling. This was when snorkeling had just become popular and scuba diving had, you know, just taken off. And going out and seeing at some of the locations we'd go to, the coral reefs, the fish, the eels, and how fascinating everything was and how interesting it was that just on the surface, you wouldn't really be able to see much, but just below that, there was a whole other planet, if you will, that no one was really seeing. So when I went to school, of course, my parents wanted me to be a doctor, but I realized that I really wanted to do something more related to animals and wildlife, so I went to marine biology. And when I returned to Haiti after college in the States, I realized that no one was doing anything to protect my ocean. So I decided to start the foundation. A few friends encouraged me, and here we are today. Hmm. We're still the only NGO in Haiti doing coastal and marine work.
Oh, wow.
After all this time, believe it or not, in a tropical Caribbean country with a coastline almost as long as that of Florida's. So we've got our work cut out for us,
wow.
That's for sure.
Why do you think you're the only one?
Well, part of the issue is that a lot of people who receive an education, a decent education in Haiti, if they don't go into the family business, will tend to leave the country. So there's a lot of brain drain certainly going on. It's fairly difficult to blame people for leaving the country, you know, if they're seeking better opportunities. And I think it's fairly hard for people after a while, even while they're away, to think about even returning to Haiti to help out. I mean, the opportunities, there aren't very many opportunities. It's a very difficult situation to work in. And I can see where a lot of people would just get discouraged and decide not to. And they're also, unfortunately, often not even encouraged by those there to return.
Hmm. Well, and I was going to ask you, I mean, even writing the intro and talking about the statistics, when we talk about Haiti in the U.S. and the media, this stat always comes up. Haiti is the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, with 80% of Haitians living in poverty. What do you think about that? I mean, how does that make you feel as a Haitian to hear this over and over and over again?
Well, it's an unfortunate fact. And with that, I'd say the 80% is in part underemployment or unemployment, which is an outrageous figure. I mean, if you think about it, most countries implode or explode with that level of unemployment. And yet in Haiti, a lot of people are, I don't know if you want to say, resigned to their fate. It seems to be kind of a Haitian thing where you try to eke out a living as best as you can and don't necessarily try to rock the boat too much, although with the arrival of more freedom after the dictatorship of the Duvaliers, that has changed a bit, in which there are more people out in the streets demanding that things be changed and that things be changed quickly. And that quickly part is often a problem where you can't always please everyone immediately. And for example, the recent changes in the Haitian government in December, I think, were a result of that, where, in my opinion at least, the current government was doing a very good job, but a lot of people thought that things weren't changing fast enough. And again, it's going to be an issue of being a little patient, because things will take time. But again, if you're hungry, you don't have time to be patient. I think it's going to continue to be an issue for a while because of the poverty level. And, you know, I just hope that there's a way where patience can prevail as we try to move the country forward and out of the mess that it's found itself in.
Jean Wiener is director and CEO of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity, an NGO that works to protect Haiti's coastal and marine resources. For the past 23 years,
Jean has been working with local communities in Haiti to protect and restore their deteriorating marine environment. And Jean is being recognized tonight. He is the winner of a Goldman Environmental Prize, which honors grassroots conservationists. It recognizes individuals for protecting and enhancing the natural world, often at great personal risk. And you can find out more about Jean's work and watch some videos of the work that he does at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call here on Local Public Radio. Today's program is pre-taped, so we cannot take any phone calls. We'll return to a live broadcast tomorrow on Your Call with Rose Aguilar. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. And at noon today, it's Backstory.
I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. And coming up tomorrow, I'll have a conversation with Robert Putman. He's out with a new book about the American dream. He takes a look at why the American dream was so attainable for his parents' generation, but is not for this generation. I hope you can join us for that. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I am speaking with Jean Wiener. He is director and CEO of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity. It's an NGO that works to protect Haiti's coastal and marine resources. This is a pre-taped interview, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. Jean is in town accepting the Goldman Environmental Prize, which honors grassroots conservationists across the world. The prize recognizes individuals for protecting and enhancing the natural world, often at great personal risk. And we've been talking about the current situation on the ground in Haiti and the NGOs that have been there, and where did all of the money go. For people who want to learn more about the NGOs that are actually doing good work in Haiti. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of people probably gave money after the earthquake. Mm-hmm. What's the best resource?
All of these organizations tend to maintain their own sites. There are a few, I can't think of them right now, but there are a few sites which kind of rate NGOs and their activities in various places. So some of those sites would be of use, but there are others. Some of the bigger NGOs, which really I think collected a lot of funding and really did a poor job on the ground. People, of course, are angry at all levels. Not only the people who gave funding to some of these NGOs to help out in Haiti, but others as well. And who are very disappointed to see that all of the money, the $10 billion which was promised, has virtually disappeared. I think that most of the money never even made it. Wow. A lot of the funding, for example, is given in kind. My understanding, for example, is from the U.S. government, for example. If the U.S. government decides to donate whatever, $100 million, and says it's going to donate $100 million and parks an aircraft carrier off of your coast for a month, and it costs them $1 million a day to run it, that's part of your donation. Hmm. So people have to understand that, too, that a lot of the money that's promised is in kind. A lot of governments, a lot of institutions will provide consultants or pay people from their country to go to Haiti and work on various things. So in the long term, and it was weird that I had to explain this to a lot of people I thought understood this type of process more, a lot of the money, and in, by some accounts, 95% or more of the money which was promised to Haiti never made it to Haiti. It went to consultants and teams going down and all, but paid for by the countries which were, which had promised to provide some financial assistance. So it ends up, it's not, even certain people in the Haitian government thought that there was going to be a check for $10 million that they were going to deposit in the bank, and everyone was going to get their cut and they'd distribute the money. But that's certainly not the way any of this runs, and it's naive to think that that's the way it goes. A lot of it is in-kind donations, and again, by some reports, 95% never saw the ground in Haiti.
What would you say at this point is most needed?
Well, what's most needed right now is serious government in Haiti. And I think we've had that for a little while. We're going into elections again very soon, and I think that I hope it doesn't change. But serious government and serious management of financial resources. I think that it's a bit difficult to engage in that type of initiative, especially on a, on an incredibly poor government's part, when you have much bigger governments kind of telling you what to do all the time. It may not correspond exactly with what the country believes its priorities are, but it will certainly be what the donor country's priorities are. And it's kind of hard to change that type of dynamic when you're really not in the driver's seat for any type of funding which comes your way. So I think there needs to be a bit more freedom for countries that are being given grants and donations and foreign aid to really say, you know, this is really what we need and these are our priorities, with some support from the donor countries or agencies. But it really almost ends up being dictated to these countries. You know, we have this amount of money for this, take it or leave it. And oftentimes they'll take it whether they need it or not. And, you know, again, some of these agencies just have a checkbox they need to tick off and be on their way.
Jean Wiener is director and CEO of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity, an NGO that works to protect Haiti's coastal and marine resources. He's been doing this work for 23 years, working with local communities in Haiti to protect the marine environment. He's in town to receive the Goldman Environmental Prize, which honors grassroots conservationists and individuals for protecting and enhancing the natural world, often at great personal risk. So let's spend more time talking about underwater world in Haiti. You mentioned that you fell in love with snorkeling when you were young. The New York Times had a piece in 2011 about the coral reefs in Haiti, and a marine biologist was quoted saying that about 85% of the reefs have died in Haiti. What are the main differences you've seen snorkeling as a child and snorkeling today?
Well, certainly a lot of the reefs are dead in Haiti, but primarily because of there was a disease in the 1980s which destroyed a lot of the two major coral building, reef building corals at that time. So a lot of Haiti's coral reef structure was destroyed. But those two coral species are now making a comeback. And our activities, some of our activities is to try to help that along. So we have what we call a coral gardens project, in which we break off pieces of coral and grow them out and then replant them on the reefs to just, you know, help Mother Nature a little bit to get things going. So a lot of the reefs are actually, except for areas closer to larger cities such as Port-au-Prince and Cape Haitien, a lot of the reefs and a lot of the areas are actually in fairly decent shape. The main issue which arises, though, is that there are very few fish I've been diving in certain places and actually been startled by a fish about 6 inches long.
Wow.
When it swims past me, because there's nothing else in the water. Our waters are so severely overfished, at least near the coral reefs and mangrove areas, that it's stunning, really. It's can't even say it's like swimming in an aquarium, because often in an aquarium there's fish.
Right.
But it's really, really stunning, that the lack of fish.
How many Haitians depend on fish and fishing for their livelihood at this point?
Well, figures are never exact, especially for Haiti, but we have estimates of about 200,000 people in the country living off of either directly as fishermen or the marketing of fish or boat construction and everything related to the fisheries industry.
And so there's not much fish to catch. And I understand that some of the fishermen actually travel hundreds of miles to the Dominican Republic to mm-hmm. catch fish.
That's correct. Haitian fishermen have been arrested as far away as Jamaica and Cuba, the Dominican Republic next door. And I've been on research cruises with NOAA to an island called Navassa, which is about 35 miles off of Haiti's coast between Haiti and Jamaica. And the fishermen have actually found it worth their time to get on a 15-foot wooden skiff and travel across 35 miles of open ocean to go out and fish at this island, because they feel that the fisheries closer to home are so severely exploited that it's not worth it. And these guys out there we've been out there for 2 weeks of research and have seen the fishermen out there on these little boats literally for 2 weeks without ever getting off of the boat.
And what do they catch?
There's decent fishing out there, but they're going after all types of fish, jacks and snapper and all types of fish. They even catch some endangered grouper sometimes. Mm. But I can't imagine that, being on a 15-foot boat and not even alone. You're out there with maybe three or four other guys on these boats for 2 weeks fishing, sleeping and eating off of these little boats. Mm. And what they do is go out, they have salt, they catch the fish, they clean them out, salt them. And then when their buckets and drums are full, they head back and oftentimes don't make it. We know of many cases where they just never heard from again. And in the Dominican Republic, Dominican Republic, the same thing. A lot of the fishermen in the northeast and southeast of Haiti feel that the fishing is better in the Dominican Republic and risk getting arrested and beaten and thrown in jail to go out and try to find better fishing and try to make a better living. Because at least in the northeast, unfortunately for a lot of the Haitian fishermen, it's a Dominican marine protected area. Mm. So when the Dominicans find them fishing in their protected area, it's often not a good scene. So they do know that there are, I mean, they see, of course, that there's diminishing fisheries resources in Haiti. So our goal as well is to try to make the fisheries more sustainable, try to find ways to make other more environmentally friendly and sustainable livelihoods for the fishermen. Everybody wants to get to the same goal. Everybody wants a better livelihood. Everybody wants their children's livelihood to be better. A lot of times people don't understand that, but everybody's goal is the same. There may be different ways of reaching it, but you know, we all want everything to be better for everyone.
Right. And we all do better when we all do better, right?
Exactly.
Now, how do you talk to fishermen about this? Because as you're talking about this, I'm just thinking about how massive this issue is. And I don't know if people have grasped it. I mean, even here in California, because of overfishing,
Our sea lions are starving. 70% of our sea lions are expected to die because they don't have enough sardines to eat. Sardines have been so overfished because they're fished in California, and then the sardines are packed into these frozen blocks, and they're sent to Japan and Australia for the bluefin tuna farms. I mean, this is so globalized at this point, and demand just keeps going up. So how are you making sense of this? And then when you draw the line at who this affects the most, it's these local fishermen and women who rely on the fish not only for their livelihoods economically, but also that's what they eat. So how are you dealing with that?
Right. No, absolutely. It's an extremely difficult situation. Up in the Northeast, where we have most of our activities now, the fishermen are out with nets in which the mesh size is way too small for what it should be, and they're catching fish by the buckets full. And most of these fish, it's not sardines, it's not anchovies, it's not little fish which are normally fairly small. A lot of it is fish which, if left to grow, would grow to decent, 10, 15 pound fish. So they're taking all the juveniles out of the water. And they can sell a bucket of fish for maybe $10, whereas if all of this fish was left to grow, they could probably catch it and sell it for $10,000. But the needs, as you just touched on, are so immediate. A lot of the times the fishermen say, if I don't catch something today, I'm not eating. So it is an extremely difficult situation with the economics in the area. The poverty levels are extreme. But as I mentioned a little bit earlier, it's a question of providing the alternatives. We cannot continue to overexploit the fisheries. A lot of institutions are interested in, for example, fish aggregating devices, which are just places, if you will, which are kind of just places where, as the name says, aggregate fish out in deeper waters. But even there, you'll catch a few bigger fish, but you're not doing anything for the sustainability. The analogy I like to use for a lot of these international organizations, which a lot of you hopefully are listening, is knowing the deforestation issue in Haiti. If a charcoal producer was to come up to you and say, there's this, stand of forests, of trees up in the mountains, and I can't get to it, but if you'd give me a four-wheel drive and a chainsaw, I could go up there and get it. Would you give him a four-wheel drive and a chainsaw to go get the last of the little trees standing up on the ridge? These fish aggregating devices, as far as we're concerned, are doing the exact same thing. They're providing the opportunity to go after the last remaining stocks which are available without providing any type of sustainability to the fisheries. So we need to provide the alternatives. We need to find environmentally friendly and sustainable alternatives. What, and they're there.
Right. What's at the top of your list for alternatives?
For alternatives, again, the honey production, the apiculture on land, and we're hoping to, for those fishermen who would prefer to stay in the ocean, algae production, seaweed production, and shellfish production, which are environmentally friendly, help the environment, they sequester carbon. You can make a decent living out of all of these. And for the fishermen who want to stay in the ocean, they can stay and continue to work in the ocean. But there are plenty of alternatives which just need to be financed, which need to be undertaken for the long term. And again, I was at meetings with the fishermen and asked them if any of you had the opportunity to find a job doing something else, would you take it? And all of them lifted their hands, because the fishing in Haiti is really, really bad. It's extremely difficult. I mean, it's I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
They don't want to be out in boats for 2 weeks in the ocean, knowing if they're going to live or survive, right?
Exactly. And go out there for what? They used to tell me, the older fishermen who are in their 80s now used to tell me that they used to go out for half a day. And at that point, felt comfortable living off of what they caught for half a day for a week or two. And now it's going out and fishing for a week or two and not being able to make enough money for half a day. So they know that there are problems. They know that things need to change. It's just a question of getting with them, having them understand that there are the options, and getting those options on the table and moving forward with them.
Jean Wiener is director and CEO of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity, an NGO that works to protect Haiti's coastal and marine resources. Jean is being recognized tonight. He won a Goldman Environmental Prize, and he'll be recognized specifically for empowering poor Haitians to protect and restore their marine environment by providing them with tools to create new opportunities. He was just talking about a few of those. And through these efforts, Jean succeeded in establishing Haiti's first ever marine protected areas. We have a lot of marine parks in California. First off, why are they so important?
Well, in terms of protecting resources, and there's really been a bit of a shift lately from marine protected areas to what we're considering now a more correct term of marine managed areas. Protection often brings up the connotation that nobody is going to be able to fish in these areas. Nobody's going to be able to enter these areas. And you know, for fishermen that you're trying to convince, that you're trying to help them, this is not the way to go.
Right. I was going to ask you what that was like in getting the MPA, right. And what did the fishermen say about that?
Exactly. So it's heading more towards the use of MMA, so marine managed area. And in Haiti, it would be virtually impossible to establish really a completely protected zones in some of these areas, because of the need and the dire circumstances of many of the fishermen. So working within these different areas, there'll be different zonings within the larger area where there'll be no fishing whatsoever, other areas where fishing will be allowed under certain circumstances and during certain seasons, perhaps areas where tourism is allowed. So there's all types of zoning which can be allowed within these different areas. And that's the type of managed area that we're trying to get going. The main premise behind that for some of these areas is if you have no-take zones, which are areas where fishermen are not allowed to fish at any point, the fish will grow peacefully within these areas, eventually, hopefully, become overcrowded and spill out into the adjoining areas where the fishermen will now be able to catch them. So you have to have, as for anything, a area set aside where your resources are allowed, especially for animals, of course, are allowed to grow and then move out of that area and repopulate the adjacent areas. So for the fishermen, we're still working with them quite closely to make sure that they understand exactly what all of this means for them and for their livelihoods in particular. It's not an easy sell, of course, as in many places in California. I'm sure a lot of the fishermen resisted big time also. So it's a question of working together. As I said previously, everybody wants to arrive to the same place, but they're just different ways of getting there. And I know I was just down at the Monterey Bay Aquarium talking to some of the people there, and the development of ecotourism. Some of the fishermen have been converted over into tour boat operators for whale watching and are making more money and are happier now than they were doing the fishing. So finding that type of dynamic is critical, where it's a win-win-win for everyone, and everybody ends up much better in the end.
How did the government respond? What role did they play when you created the MMA?
Well, actually, again, I can't take full credit for any of this, of course, because in the end, it's the government that has to sign off
right
on all of this. But we, since about 2000... we're undertaking different types of activities to determine the best sites for the potential development of marine managed areas, and undertook studies on what's now currently being called ecosystem services, which are the services or the capital that a lot of these ecosystems provide, such as for mangroves, that they protect the shore from erosion, that they allow for beach stabilization, that they break waves when there are storm surges, and they also sequester carbon, and they provide important nurseries for fish, and coral reefs do a few of the same types of things. So realizing the importance and the adding a value to some of these ecosystem services is critical, and it provides the politicians with something that they can use and something that they can understand, which prior to this was not available. The politicians will understand economics and dollar signs. Hmm. So this use of ecosystem services does just that. It tells you, you know, this mangrove area over here, if you removed it, you'd lose, you know, beach erosion control. You might be affected by storms. You might lose houses along the shoreline if there's a storm. The fisheries in your coastal waters might be depleted by this amount. So it's worth $1 million, for example. And the politicians can grasp that more readily than a biologist coming and telling them, well, you know, the Rhizophora mangala and the Acropora palmata and la 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 and all of this stuff, which, you know, they'll glaze over like a TV screen with snow and not understand a thing that you're saying. But if you can put dollar figures on it, I think you can expand the understanding of most people of what exactly you're actually losing when these ecosystems are damaged or lost.
You're in San Francisco to accept this prize tonight. What is your current project? What's next for you when you go back to Haiti?
Well, we're working on several projects right now along the lines of everything we've discussed. We've been doing these for a while now. The support from the Goldman Prize, the funding is certainly going to go help us expand a lot of these activities, the mangrove reforestation, the coral reef restoration, the work with the local communities, and trying to develop a lot of these initiatives to help the local communities. So when I head back again in a couple of weeks, it's going to be back to business as usual and trying to really engage the local communities in trying to make their livelihoods a bit more stable and a bit better.
Jean Wiener is director and CEO of the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity, an NGO that works to protect Haiti's coastal and marine resources. Jean and his group provided data to support the creation of Haiti's first two marine protected areas. And he is in town receiving the Goldman Environmental Prize, which honors grassroots conservationists. Jean, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
How is growing inequality affecting our kids' future? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam about his new book, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, a groundbreaking work exploring the inequality of opportunity between rich kids and poor kids. How does inequality affect social mobility, and what should be done about it? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.